the new theater of the mind. The Bruce Collins Show.
Welcome back to the Bruce Collins Show. We're very glad to have you join us. Tonight, we ask the question, have you ever gone into the woods and not returned to civilization? Well, of course you have, because you wouldn't be listening to this program tonight otherwise. But did you know that many people go into the woods, the dark, scary woods, alone, sometimes in small groups, and they disappear? We know this from many news stories. Our guest tonight, under the pen name Stephen Young, has written the book, Something in the Woods is Taking People. Steph Young joins us later in the hour. The Bruce Collins Show airs every Friday night at midnight right here at WWPR, 1490 AM. You can listen to past archives of The Bruce Collins Show at ipbn-fm.com. That's ipbn-fm.com. There's a banner just for The Bruce Collins Show on the Intrepid Paradigm Broadcasting Network website. Click on the show banner and you will go right to our page. We would appreciate it also if you're able to spread the word for our show by word of mouth, social media, or in whatever creative way you can. Also, we have a Facebook page for The Bruce Collins Show. Please like us there. And you can email the show at bruce_collins_show@AOL.com. It's always great to hear from you. We believe we have a unique show every week planned for you, and we're honored to have you aboard. The Bruce Collins Show also has a YouTube channel. Visit YouTube, search for The Bruce Collins Show channel, subscribe, and catch all the latest shows on YouTube. Before we get to our guest tonight, I just want to say Chad Miles and I are also featured in another program called the Revolving Door Radio Program at ipbn-fm.com. And what the Revolving Door Radio Program is, it's a collection of four separate groups of hosts on this program. So once a month, Chad Miles and I host the Revolving Door Radio Program there at ipbn-fm.com. We hope you can join us for that program. And now, Steph Young, a.k.a. Stephen Young, has written the book, Something in the Woods is Taking People. Tonight, we'll find out who or what is taking people in a moment. And joining us this week is Steph Young. She has written a very eye-opening and very interesting book, Something in the Woods is Taking People. The author credited is Stephen Young. So when you go to Amazon, you'll want to put in Stephen Young, Something in the Woods is Taking People. But we're here with the real author this week, Steph Young. And Steph Young, welcome to the Bruce Collins Show.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you on. Now, tell us about yourself and give us an overview of your books.
Okay, I guess I started about 4 years ago writing. Initially, I was writing for magazines, and I was gathering so much information that I thought I really need to put these into books. And I started out doing books on near-death experiences and afterlife communication, and then I decided I wanted to write one about time travelers. And it was actually as a result of writing that book that the idea came out to look at what was going on in the woods and mountains, because I was finding places which seemed to have what locals or elders would call dimensions or portals. And then people were disappearing, but there were also added factors, other things going on inside them. So, for example, there's a forest called Makawasi in Peru, which is said to be, it's a stone forest, and it's said to have portals or dimensions there, and people go missing. And the government ministers had actually gone missing one time, and they were just walking around, and the search parties were looking for them. And they could see the search parties, and they were shouting out to them, but the search party couldn't see them. So it was almost as if, you know, they were in another dimension. And there's another place called Bustegi Mountain, which is in the Carpathians in Romania. And there were two brothers that were climbing there, and one of them suddenly disappeared on the rock face, you know, supposedly. And the police and the searchers were sort of looking for him, and at one stage they were going to charge the brother with murder. But the elders there were talking about how watches and electronics stop working, and people get lost for days there, and they don't know where. Well, they reappear, but they don't know where they've been or what's happened to them, and they're not hungry, they're not thirsty. And there was supposedly, there's a guy called Peter Moon, and he was working with a Romanian researcher, and he wrote a book about there being some kind of tunnel in the mountain that had had a geometric barrier to it that had to be broken down, and all these findings, you know, giant skeletons and some kind of time travel technology. Well, I don't know about that, but, you know, so there's lots of different aspects that seem to kind of pop up. And there's another place called Mount Kailash, which is another forest and a mountain. And there's a geophysicist, Dr. Robert Sosh from Boston University, and he'd gone there because another professor had written a book which had supposedly been banned because of what had been found in the mountain. And he was doing some meditation with a group who was writing about this, and on the peak of the mountain they were all just sitting down, and it was dark, and there was a sudden flash of light, and they saw these two black hooded figures. So, and there's another place as well, I could go on, but there's another place called Ballyboley in Ireland, which is another forest. It's a much smaller one. But ancient texts there speak about druids and a portal to a druid otherworld. And there was, you know, writings about people going missing there. But more recent paranormal incidents are people go in there and they see these black hooded figures, and they sort of, there's a couple of reports where people have said they've seen blood on trees. Well, I don't know if they're imagining it or what they're seeing, but it was when I was investigating all these different places, really for, you know, the time travel aspect or the portals or the dimensions, that I was coming across these other possibilities. And a lot of these forests and mountains, they have UFO sightings. So I'm thinking, well, okay, is it geomagnetic, or is it UFOs? Is it paranormal figures? Is there dimensions? And I went on a quest to find more examples of people disappearing or people getting lost for a while and coming back, and what might have happened to them. And also, I mean, I know, obviously, I've heard about David Paulides' books as well. I haven't read them yet, but I have listened to some of his shows, and, you know, it's very, very prevalent, isn't it, in the national parks as well. So it's quite amazing. But there are so many different possibilities, and just as you think you've got to the bottom of something, generally it will lead off into another direction, which is even more mysterious.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we're speaking with Steph Young. She's the author of Something in the Woods is Taking People. And remember, when you look for that book, Something in the Woods is Taking People, the author name is Stephen Young. But Steph, before we delve into specifics in your book, where can people find you online?
Really, it's just through Amazon for the books, but I've got a Facebook, which is Steph Young Author. So generally, it's probably best to, you can contact me on Facebook. That's probably the best.
Okay, excellent. Now, in regards to your book, Something in the Woods is Taking People, are there a lot of people disappearing in the woods without a trace?
Well, it's actually quite hard to know in some ways, because in America, for example, the national parks don't keep official records, although they do list missing people quite often, but you don't normally necessarily get to find out what's happened. The good way of sort of finding out in a way is to go on Google and just bring up examples and look in local newspapers, because they're always reported in the local papers. So the Adirondack News, for example, have listed 300 missing or injured in the national parks in that area. And the Oregonian in 2013 said there's 240 missing, but that's over a decade. And then you find other figures quoted elsewhere. So it's actually hard to come up with a number, but it does seem to be a worldwide phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about some of the possibilities regarding who or what is taking people in the woods. And one of the things you brought up is missing time. And whenever I hear someone talk about missing time, I think of UFOs and alien abductions. What does your research uncover about UFOs and alien involvement in terms of something in the woods taking people?
I've come across an awful lot of reports that sound like they could be. There's quite a well-known one, which is Todd Sees, who was in the Montreal Ridge in Northumberland County in Pennsylvania in 2002, and he'd left his home. Now, this is covered, actually. It was uncovered by Peter Davenport of the MUFON, and it has been taken up by Butch Witkowski and Lonnie Strickler of Phantom and Monsters, so they're kind of the experts in it. But in 2002, he left his home in Northumberland County to go to do some pre-season deer spotting. And he'd taken his ATV up to the top of the mountain. He hadn't come home for lunch, and his wife was concerned, so she called the police, and they started a search by 2 p.m. And there was about 200 volunteers. They found his ATF at the top of the mountain, but the canines couldn't find a scent. And then 2 days later, they found him in a pond, which was really close to his house, and it had been searched. He was barely dressed, and his body was emaciated, which is not the condition that you'd find it in if it had only been gone missing for a couple of days. And most importantly, I suppose, is that it took the rescuers specialist equipment to hack into the area where he was found. So he didn't have any cutting equipment himself, so it's a bit strange as to how he could have got into that area in the first place. But his boot was found in a tree about a mile away, so that was kind of a little bit, a suggestion there. And also there had been some farmers nearby who said they'd seen UFOs in the sky, or lights. So, possibly. But that brought to mind a case that happened in 1980 in the UK, in Todmorden, which is in rural Yorkshire, so it's very countrified there. And a man went missing in the small town there, and he was found 5 days later. His body was on top of a coal pile in a coal mine. But the owner's son had been there that morning, and he definitely hadn't seen him there, so he kind of appeared afterwards. And the police found some burn marks on his shoulders that were covered in strange green ointment, which was never scientifically identified. And his clothes had been buttoned up the wrong way, and his shirt was missing, and there was no footprints in the coal. So the pathologist said that he died that day, but his burn marks were 2 days prior to that. But the pathologist couldn't determine how he died, but he said he died of a heart attack from fright, and his face contorted with fear. But interestingly, one of the policemen that went to investigate, he was on his night shift not long after that, and he was looking for missing cows who disappeared from a field. And there was a strange glowing object that came in front of him, and at first he thought it was a bus or a lorry, a truck. He tried to radio for colleagues, but his radio was dead, and he was too scared to leave the car. But he then noticed about half an hour of time had just gone. And when he looked at the boots of his shoes, he saw that the soles were split wide open as though he'd been dragged along the ground. Hmm. And he was so disturbed by this. And actually, sorry, on the same night, independently, other drivers had reported seeing strange lights, and a couple of police in other areas had said they'd seen things. Well, this policeman, Godfrey, was so disturbed by what he'd gone through, he asked if he could be hypnotized, and when he was, he described himself being in a room with a black hooded, bearded man with a kind of biblical appearance, and a huge black dog, and there were other smaller creatures about the size of 5-year-olds, and they were moving robotically. And quite interestingly as well, when I did the book after this one, I came across an investigator called Mark Patrick Gibbons, who has identified, he says, ley lines which have been purposely blackened. I can sort of go into that later maybe, because it's quite a long explanation, but in that area specifically, he'd gone around and spoken to people, and there was supposedly some kind of occult ritual practice that had been going on for decades there. And he had found in his research that 95% of UFO abductions and poltergeist and demonic experiences had all occurred along the lines of ley lines, which possibly had been blackened, which is where you negatively charge the energy there. And he had found that particular area had had that, he says, sort of, manipulated. So, again, so you start off with a UFO thing, and then you go on to something else, which could be a cult manipulation. But I do have to say that I, in some respects, I haven't gone greatly into all the UFO sightings and experiences, because I think there's so many people out there that are absolute experts in it that I feel it's not my sort of specialism, or it's been done very well by other people.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating, though. Now, again, in your book, Something in the Woods is Taking People, it's by Steph Young, you write about stories of invisible assailants. Now, that's spooky. Can you touch on this phenomena?
Yeah, and it's crazy. It really is. I found an old journal. It's called the Scots Magazine, and it's the oldest journal in publication still, and it was first issued in 1739. And there was a very strange incident that they wrote about there that happened in a part of northern Italy in the woods. And the story was that there were five women, and they were collecting wood fire, and suddenly one of them cried out and just fell to the ground dead in front of her friends. And obviously, at first you could say, well, you know, I suspect they attacked her, but a doctor was there and he examined what had happened. And her clothes and even her shoes were torn to shreds and scattered all around her, and she had the most horrific wounds. Her skull was visible and her intestines were hanging out, and most of her internal organs had been ruptured. And it was recorded in the French Academy of Sciences by a professor. So you kind of think, well, you know, you tend to believe that sort of thing, even though you can't really understand how that could have possibly happened. Mm-hmm. Because there was no blood at the scene, and the parts of her flesh that had been taken out of her body weren't there at the scene either. So, I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. But I found also James Allen Rennie, who was a famous explorer, and he was in remote northern Canada in 1924, and he was crossing a frozen lake with his guide. And he saw these tracks appearing over the frozen lake. And it was getting closer and closer, and then something splashed him with water as it got closer. But he couldn't see anything, and then it impacted against him and then carried on, leaving tracks as it went. And he wrote in his diaries about the trek that he did, and he wrote about it. And he said, you know, there was something there, but I just couldn't see it. And so I was looking for more and more examples of this, and I came across this creature as such, who is in the Cairngorm Mountains in Scotland, and it's called the Grey Man. And there was the head of the climbing organisation there. They were having a general meeting, and he said, I feel really stupid talking about this, but I'm going to tell you. And he started to describe how he'd been on the mountain himself, and he had heard footsteps behind him, but they sounded so much bigger than his. And at first he thought, well, they're my footsteps, they're echoing, but they were coming at different times to his, and they sounded much heavier. And in the end, he just ran down to the trees at the bottom, you know. And after the meeting, he had a couple of other climbers come up to him and say, well, we've had the same experience. We've had this sensation of something chasing us, but we can't see anything. But they said, we've also had this feeling that we just have to throw ourselves off the mountain, this feeling of doom, that we have to kill ourselves. And then again, so that, this feeling, this sensation was something else I looked into, where people hear voices and things, but then again, that goes off into another trade. But there was a politician as well of the National Party in Scotland, and she'd gone up, not as high, but she was walking along there as well. And she heard a voice which was talking in Gaelic, which is, an old, you know, old Scottish. And but she couldn't see anybody around, and then she started hearing these footsteps behind her. And again, she hurried off. But there was also a friend of mine actually forwarded something, a BBC, a climbing, outdoors journalist. And he'd recently gone up into the Cairngorms, and he was climbing and really high. And so they were putting the ice picks in. And then he heard this horrific scream, and he just thought, well, somebody has just fallen to their death. But he couldn't go down to look. He had to go up before he could come down. But when they descended, they asked the search people, who are you looking for? And they said, nobody. And they did all these investigations to try and find out if somebody had, you know, fallen, but they hadn't. Anyway, I'm going off onto a different subject, which is the voices and things. But the invisible ones, to get back to that, sorry, there's another writer called Russ Chastain, who's he writes about hunting, and he described his first hunting trip with his father, and they'd set up in separate trees, and then all the animals, the birds, everything had gone quiet, and it was dusk, but you could still see. And he could see the bushes moving in front of him and felt this terrible sense of doom. And then he saw out of the corner of his eye there was something moving behind him, but he couldn't see anything, couldn't see an animal. And then he heard this most horrific scream, which he said was part animal, part ethereal, part spirit. But his father didn't hear it, and he was, you know, within meters of his father. And recently, somebody wrote to me called Susie, and she was staying with her sister in a subdivision, wooded subdivision in Hampstead, New Hampshire. And it was a few years ago. And she, when the family used to go to bed, she'd go out onto the deck and have a smoke in the dark. And she used to hear these sticks breaking. And she, you know, her email is very, very thorough. And it says, you know, I grew up, my parents were scout leaders. I camped all the time. I know the sounds of animals. It wasn't a Bigfoot. They don't live in that area. But I know what animals make noises and what noises they make. She said, but I couldn't work it out because they were coming from different parts of the director, so from in front and from behind. And in the morning, she got her 11-year-old nephew to go out and jump on the sticks to see, you know, how heavy this thing was that was breaking them. But he couldn't break them, but she could. So she thought, well, they're quite big. Anyway, so one night, it seems to carry on. And then one night, she said, I was having a smoke again. But she's convinced to this day that there was something there and that she would be indoors and see shadows as though something, shadows on the ceiling as though something was passing or watching her. It's quite a scary story, you know, the way she's described it. But, you know, she really does believe it. And there's so many different cases. I read one of a lady in Tennessee, which she contacted MUFON. And she was on her deck, and it was 6 a.m. in the morning. She was having a coffee, and it was daylight. And she looked to the side of her deck, and she could see this massive black shadow, which kind of sort of peeled itself off. But it was much bigger than the actual deck, so it was much taller, more than 12 foot. And then it kind of started to move away, but it turned its head, but it had no face. And I'm going into things that you can see now, aren't I? But I've got so many different stories, because I've written a book called Predators in the Woods, and there are so many different descriptions. So they go from being invisible. I've got accounts where they're shimmering predator-type things, okay, which sounds crazy again, but you can't see them. You can see a shimmering type gossamer effect. And then I, you know, for the invisible, there's the sky beasts or the atmospheric beings, which again sounds insane, but a Navy vet, Trevor Constable, was writing about them. He spent about two decades, and they're something that you can't see in the sky. You can see them with infrared. And more recently, I contacted somebody who does it in England, and you can see it with ultraviolet, I believe it is. They slow the cameras right down, and they're almost like amoeba-ish clouds, but you can't see them. Now, people who've studied them say that they're sort of amorphous, they shift, and the theory there is that they change their density so that you may be able to see them at some point. And, you know, people who were studying them, like Trevor Constable, said these are the things that take people. These are the things that cause cattle mutilation. Now, I don't know about cattle mutilation because it's quite sort of technical the way it's done. But, you know, there's the theory there that there's something that we can't see, but that has some kind of intelligence. You know, again, I don't know. But you hear so many stories, I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's amazing. I've never heard of these stories before, so I'm just fascinated by them. Now, you touched on shadow people, but here's an interesting question, and I didn't notice this in your book. A lot of people here experience shadow people also in their homes and things like that. But one of the things that, and you just mentioned him as Bigfoot. He didn't really make it to your book, I don't think, at least not a chapter. Do you hear anything about Bigfoot in terms of, I've never seen him as a violent creature. Would you agree with that?
I put some accounts in the Predators book. But again, I think the reason I stayed away from Bigfoot, I mean, it's a very, very strong possibility that that's what's causing it. But again, I felt it's such an area that's so well covered by people. I was trying to kind of get different angles, but I don't know. I mean, you know, is it interdimensional or is it flesh and blood? It's such a difficult thing to know.
Yeah.
And you said you didn't hear of any malevolent incidents.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there's plenty of accounts of that. But again, it's always you know, unless you're there and you experience it, how do you know?
Right.
You know, somebody who's been there and experienced it. I mean, I had an experience of what I think was probably a shadow person. But when you describe it to somebody, it sounds ridiculous. And you can't understand it yourself either. So with all these things, until you see something or you experience it, it's very hard to say, well, okay, that's definitely what's happening, or that's definitely true. And with Bigfoot, I mean, it's so elusive, isn't it? I don't know.
Yes. Let me remind the listeners, the book is Something in the Woods is Taking People. The author is Stephen Young. We're here with the actual author. Her real name is Steph Young. Now, Steph, can you talk about the mysterious cases of children who have gone missing?
Yeah, of course. I found a case in the Brecon Beacons, which is in Wales, and it happened in 1900. And the Brecon Beacons is where the SAS trained, so it's really very rugged and quite harsh terrain. And a miner, coal miner, was taking his son, who's 5 years old, to see his grandparents who lived on a farm on the Brecon Beacons in a valley there. And it was a public holiday, so they set out and they got to the nearest train station at about early evening, and then they had a 5 mile walk to reach the farmhouse, which is in the valley. And by 8 p.m. they'd reached a military camp where they stopped and they could buy drinks and biscuits at the canteen, and they were going to rest for a little while before walking on. But their grandfather arrived, so he had his 13-year-old nephew with him, and the grandfather said, run back to the house and just tell them that we're all going to be back, you know, for dinner soon. And the little boy, Tommy, wanted to go, and it was still daylight, so his father said, yeah, of course. And he only got part of the way before he started to cry, and he said, I want to walk back. So the nephew said, okay, well, I'll just run to the farmhouse, and he ran off. The little boy was going to walk back to his father and grandfather. But by about 10 minutes, the nephew had got back to the military camp and rejoined the grandfather and the father, but the little boy wasn't there, so he hadn't made it back. So immediately they started searching, and they asked all the army people to help in. They searched for about midnight, and then they stopped because it was too dark, and then at 3 a.m. they started looking again. But they couldn't see any sign of him, and over the days, and it got into weeks, they were hacking all of the bracken, so it was pretty much just bare, the mountain. And they covered every spot, and they offered rewards, and they searched the local gypsies' homes and caravans and questioned all the army people. And so they couldn't find anybody that they thought had taken him, but they couldn't find him. And then the really weird thing is that there was a lady called Mrs. Hammers, and she was the wife of a gardener who lived in a castle a few miles away. And she'd never been to the Beacons, but she kept having these dreams about where the boy could be. And they were recurring every night. So eventually she said to her husband, let's borrow a pony trap, we've got to go there. So they went there. She took him to one of the peaks, and they were walking across the flat ridge when they came across the little boy, and he was in the middle of the open space, really. And obviously he was deceased by that time. But nobody could understand how he'd walked so far and got so high up, because it was 3,350 feet, and he was barefoot, and he'd already walked quite a distance, you know, that day. Nobody could understand, and what's eerier as well is that he had a little whistle around his neck, but he didn't use it. But I don't know whether he was too young, he didn't understand, or he just got lost. But it was in the National Trust journal. National Trust, they sort of run the public spaces, you know, the parks. So it seemed to be a very true story, but really, really strange. But there's several like that. So there's another little boy called Ottie Powell in 1890. He was in Amherst County in Virginia. And he was at school, and his schoolmistress sent all the children out to collect some wood fire. And he didn't return. So immediately they shut the school, got the children to go home, get the parents. And it was on the Appalachian Trail. It was in the George Washington National Forest by Bluff Mountain. And it was so thick, the woodland there. And hundreds of people were looking for him. And again, it turned into days, into weeks. And 7 months later, some hunters were out, and their dog started barking, and they followed the dog, and it went up a steep path. And he was again up the top of the mountain. And I managed to find a local lady there who's a gardener, and she writes blogs. And she'd gone on the hike herself with her husband. And she wrote that it felt like walking up a flight of stairs for 2 hours. And she's you know, she's saying, I can't understand how a child could have done it. So it's very strange, you know, these things that happen. And there was another one in Pennsylvania in the Allegheny Mountains, Joseph George Cox in 1866. And they both disappeared from their parents' backyard, but it was inside, you know, the forest area. And again, everybody lit fires and trying to draw them out from where they were, and hundreds of people were looking. And it was another case where a farmer who lived a few miles away, and he'd only just moved to that area, and he kept having this recurring dream that there was, that he was in the search party and he discovered the boys. And he told his wife, and he didn't know the area, even, you know, he just moved there. But he described the geography and the features and the things that he saw. And in the end, his wife's brother said, okay, well, let's go and look. And again, they followed the route, but it was over creeks, it was up steep ravines, and again, they found the two boys. I think the weirdest thing is the psychic link there. I think it's quite astonishing, but, you know, there are lots and lots of cases, and it's adults and it's children. It's just so many baffling cases, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the book is Something in the Woods is Taking People. And in your book, you talk about beliefs of something under the ground taking people in the woods.
Yeah. There's a few things on that. El Yunque, which is a rainforest in Puerto Rico, and there's a really strong tradition of belief there that there's UFOs that come in, either come into the mountainsides or they go in through the water. And there's lots of testimonies from policemen and army people. A group of school children just went missing completely, and two Marines went missing there. And there's lots of accounts of seeing strange humanoid figures. And they come from policemen and they come from army people. And so you think, I don't know, but there's reports, you know, of it being some kind of subterranean base. This is an area, again, that has been really covered by people, you know, like John Rhodes, who's the alien hunter and talks about reptilian bases underground, and that these reptilians come up and they abduct people and they take them back underground. In Mountain Yungani in Zimbabwe, there was a shaman there, and he was collecting herbs on the mountainside and amongst all the rough trees, and he said that he found himself suddenly inside a mountain on a table, and there were these reptilian figures working on him. But again, it's an area that's been, you know, general reports of it have been going on for so long. And there was a man called Billy Shaver in the 40s. Now, he wrote about his experience to the magazine Amazing Stories. Well, Amazing Stories, as it sounds, used to sort of embellish things. So at first you think, well, I don't know, it's science fiction. But he says that there were two warring alien races living underground. They were sending thoughts to him. And that he'd been taken underground by a holographic image that had led him. And he said these two warring races, one were peaceful, one were not. The ones that weren't would actually come up, take people and actually eat them underground. And you think, well, you know, I'm sure they made that up. But then the editor himself, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but he said he heard different voices coming out of this man, Shaver, that weren't his own voices, and they were discussing the murder of a woman on one of the bases underground. So, and the interesting thing is that after they'd published the articles, they then had lots and lots of people sending letters in saying, we've had experiences with reptilians. So, again, I don't know. And there's another man called Billy Woodard, and he was a former Air Force officer, and he said that he was abducted at quite a young age and taken in through a vortex, which is something that they can manipulate. And they take you down into a base, and it's a hollow earth base. And he said that the creatures like Bigfoot use these vortexes to come back up and then can go back down into them. What was interesting, I think, for me, what was something I hadn't heard of was when I was doing the follow-up book, and I came across the idea that an archaeologist called Graham Stewart had said that in Malta, there was a discovery. They were just doing some random sort of work, basically on a well, but it led to the discovery of some huge tunnels and caves and chambers. And he had said, because 7,000 odd skeletons were found inside, he said that, you know, underground beings, they demand humans, they come and take humans. That these mythological creatures do actually exist, and the governments have known for ages, and they feed off humans. And a lady who was working as a secretary at the British Embassy in Malta, she'd actually gone down on a trip to investigate the caves. And she made the claim that there were these figures. She was on a ridge, and there was a huge sort of empty hollow cavern. And on the other side was another ridge, and she said that these beings just materialized along the ridge, about 20 of them, and they were absolutely huge, and they had cowls over their heads and long white hair, and they were beckoning her with their fingers. And then actually, it seems to be a true story, a group of school children and their teachers disappeared inside the cave. And when she sent her story into, I forget the journal, sorry, but it was a quite a respected journal, and the editor there thought, well, this is just fantasy, but he made the investigations and corroborated that the school children had disappeared, and began to think, okay, maybe there's something to this. But when we talk of something underground, so there's the ancient races, there's reptilians, and then you've got the there's people like Miles Johnson in the UK who runs a series of talks and lectures, and it's called the Basis Project. And he has interviewed so many people that claim to have been military abducted and taken underground, whether it's in the UK or Canada or America, and working with aliens underground who are in there. Some of the people who give testimony to him over the years have said that they're generated life forms, and they're working sort of more or less under the control of the military or government, and they use, on their victims, they will use mind control, they'll do genetic testing. And then you've got the people who have come out and said they're super soldiers, who've been used as child, abducted as children, taken underground, all these experiments used on them. And then there's the tie-in, would they say, using occult ritual workings to harness this power. So, again, you start off with one thing, and it kind of leads into another thing, and then you've got the occult coming into it, and,
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the... There's even people who suggest that maybe some of the UFO experiences are military involvement. So it's really fascinating how all of these different ideas and different theories kind of overlap. So it's very interesting. Now, you mentioned ancient races, and I've never forgotten this, but when I was a kid, I used to collect old radio shows from the 40s and the 50s here in the United States. And there was a television show about 20 years ago called Unsolved Mysteries. But then that was also based on a radio show, and I never knew that until I was collecting these old shows. And there was a radio show called Unsolved Mysteries, and one of the shows was about an ancient race that existed on Mount Shasta in California. And I never forgot that, because what's interesting about some of these stories is they've gone on. I mean, maybe they've evolved, but like your The Amazing Stories story, some of these stories have been around quite a while about races and things going on in the woods, and so it's interesting, and it probably should take note of that, because some of these theories and ideas have some staying power. Now, in your book, Something in the Woods is Taking People, again by Stephen Young, and we're speaking with the real author, Steph Young, you have a chapter asking if the work of Satanists could be responsible. Can you share with us some of these stories?
Yeah, there's almost sort of two sides to this in a way. So I came across incidences of people disappearing or being found dead, and that possibly being the work of satanic groups. So, for example, there was a little boy called Victor Shoemaker, and he disappeared in Hampshire County, which is near Kirby, in 94, and they started calling the forest that swallowed the little boy afterwards. And I tried to get hold of all the different newspaper reports about this, because I wanted to see what could possibly have been a reason, because he disappeared while he was playing with his two cousins. But he said he wanted to go back home, and they said they let him, but he was never found again. Despite, going over the place with a tooth comb. So I had to get hold of all the different reports and try and find something, and I wasn't coming up with anything at all. And then I found one tiny sentence in one of the articles, and it said about, the fact that a little triangle had been found. So it was formed of rocks and twigs, and it was formed into a triangle. I didn't make any speculation about that, but then I thought, well, I've written books about demon possession and things like that, so was it some kind of ritual summoning thing? Was it an occult thing? And I did see that the day that he went disappeared was on the 1st of May, and if you look into the Illuminati, that's supposed to be a sacred day of human sacrifice, and the period from April the 19th to May the 1st is supposed to be a critical 13-day period when it's the regeneration period, so they offer sacrifices to the beast, you know, supposedly. So I was thinking, well, I wonder if that had anything to do with it, and I kind of went on a massive path down that route in the follow-up book, looking at the possibility of that for years, again, there has been claims of, you know, elite groups that do this kind of thing, and abduction rings, and there have been child abductions where there was the Johnny Gosch case and the Finders and the Franklin cover-up, all of that. So it's a massive thing. It's sort of so much you can read about that. But it's a possibility that these things do go on, and, you know, 50 to 80,000 children go missing in the States each year, so where do they go? So from looking at one little case, you think, well, maybe that was some kind of ritual. Maybe it wasn't. And somebody wrote to me, actually, afterwards and pointed out to me, well, it doesn't mean that it was a bad ritual. It could have been a positive one. And that's absolutely true, you know. But you have to make these suppositions to try and link things up and try and get some kind of theory going, which doesn't mean it's right. But then there was also a case of the Jameson family who disappeared in the Latina Mountains in October 2009. And they went out in their car, father, mother and the daughter and the dog, to look at some land they were thinking of buying. They wanted to get somewhere quieter to where they were living. And they disappeared. And they had dogs, they had horseback, they had ATVs. In fact, they had 16 teams of dogs looking for them, but they found no tracks and no scent. Eventually, they found a few days later the truck, which had £30,000 worth of dollars in it, and the dog. And there was the idea maybe it was a drug deal got wrong, perhaps. But I was reading the Oklahoman newspaper, and the mother had said that she thought her family were on a cult hit list. And there had been a ritual kind of killing. A pastor in the town there had been killed and left in a satanic pose in the church. Their bodies were found about 4 miles away on the other side of the ridge. But the thing with them was that they were both on disability, and the father was supposed to be quite often in very debilitating pain, you know, so he couldn't really walk very far. And Red Dirt News, which is a local news place there, pointed out that their death occurred at the 33rd North Parallel, which is supposed to be the occult line of tragedy. Again, there's that tie-in with, you know, the occult, the Illuminati, and sacrifices, and you can look back in time to occult scholars who used to say that the 33rd is the kill number, it's the killing of the king's ritual, and when you kill somebody on that line, you perform the ritual, and their life force is passed into you, and, you know, they make the argument, people like John Downard make the argument that ritual killings are carried out there. To counter that, you can say, well, you know, killings carried out cattle line, so he couldn't go any further. He was a few miles off the highway. He was near a lake, but there was no scent, no trace. He couldn't really work out how he'd gone missing or why. And going back to Jameson's, I kind of took it further again, because when I was doing the initial research, I came across, I know it was initially called Smiley Face Killers. I know it's not called that anymore, but that's probably what people would best know it for, where college-age boys in Wisconsin and quite a few other states were going missing and being found dead in ponds, lakes, or water. And if you look into all of that research, you find that there are some deaths that really don't add up. It doesn't look like they just accidentally drowned. You've got a case where one body was drained of blood. You've got others that were put in water, but they didn't die that day. They were kept somewhere, and then they were put in water. And again, I did a lot of research into what this kind of ritual might be. It could be some kind of alchemy ritual. It could be that these people are being gang-stalked and targeted and killed for this alchemy, which, again, goes off into a massive other direction, and it's very, very intensive to sort of research and look into and explain. But it's another possibility. And then for the book after Something in the Woods, Taken in the Woods, I really followed the route for one of the chapters on the ley lines and the fact that ley lines supposedly can be you've got people like David Icke, you've got a numerologist called Ellis Taylor, you've got an expert in ley lines called David Gowan. Now, all of these people believe that ley lines, so for someone like Stonehenge or Mount Shasta or Sedona, they're very, very positive. And you can possibly say that people experience healings or positive feelings around these places. If you look at it in the exact opposite way, other theorists say that there are ley lines. Now, the problem with ley lines is that you can't, but there is the theory that these are deliberately sort of blackened, which means that there's rituals carried out on them. Now, the rituals themselves give this supposed elite satanic group in seeking to control the world, they supposedly give it the negative energy. And the numerologist that I was talking about, Ellis Taylor, he categorically says, and so does David Icke, actually, when you read it, that disappearances, particularly of children, but adults as well, have been carried out on purpose, and you can trace the line of the ley line from a place of beginning to end. Now, these lines might go through Stonehenge, but they might go through occult places, so places where satanic groups meet, whether that's churches themselves or, you know, and they can track the trace. But also when somebody goes missing and you've got all that fear and worry and concern, it uses that negative energy up. Now, it's all very fringe, isn't it, to think in terms of this? And whether you give it credence or not, I don't know, but there's a lot of very... Because I don't categorically say that any of this is the answer. But I like to try and raise as many possibilities as possible from what I find from other researchers, from other theories, and try and get some kind of cohesiveness going.
Yeah. And again, the book that we've been speaking about this week is Something in the Woods is Taking People by Stephen Young. And the actual author is Steph Young. Now, before you go, and I would love to have you back sometime, but talk about your books, the different books, and where people can purchase your books.
Okay, they're all on Amazon. Mysterious Things is the first one. It kind of covers things like Thunderbirds, Dogmen, all of the kind of strange things that could take people. Something in the Woods is the one we've been talking about. The one after that is Predators in the Woods, which is more about these strange cryptid sightings, whether it's invisible, whether it's black stick men, whether it's another predator. And then Taken in the Woods is where I've kind of gone on a next step with looking at ley lines, looking at, you know, the mortar example, looking at all these other different theories. And hopefully, I'm working on the next one, which will probably bring even more ideas up. Because it is such an enigma. I mean, it's, you know, that's where the fascination lies, to be honest, because you can't solve this mystery at the moment. But it does raise so many possibilities and so many linkings. So many things are linked.
Yeah. And again, we've been speaking with the author, Stephen Young, a.k.a. Steph Young. And specifically, we were talking about the book, Something in the Woods is Taking People. But you can go on Amazon.com and look up Stephen Young and find all of her books. Steph, I hope you can come back the next time and talk more about this. This was really fascinating.
I'd love to. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, Grace.
Thank you.
Soon you'll be able to walk into your Admiral dealer's store and confidently buy the style radio or radio phonograph you want. The selection of Admiral radios will be complete. There'll be radio phonographs with the famous Admiral exclusive features, slide away that makes loading and unloading your record changer so easy, and the foolproof Admiral automatic record changer. There'll be consoles and table models and newly designed cabinets of fine woods and modern plastics. There'll be farm sets and portables in many styles and sizes, including the popular Admiral Bantam, the camera-type radio that operates on alternating current, direct current, or self-contained batteries. There'll be new electronic refinements in AM, FM, and shortwave reception. And now about television. Admiral's extensive research assures television receivers with true Admiral quality. So, whatever you want in radio, you'll find it in an Admiral, America's smart set. You can get a very good idea of what Admiral will offer if you'll write for a free copy of the new full-colored booklet entitled It's a Promise from Admiral. Just write your name and address on a penny postcard and mail it to Admiral in care of this radio station. That's all. Just your name and address mailed to Admiral at this station.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bruce Collins at The Bruce Collins Show. Thank you so much for joining us each and every week, Fridays at midnight on WWPR 1490 AM. We would ask that you would support all of your favorite charities that help to spread the gospel, clothe the needy, and feed the hungry. You can do that as thanks for listening to our program. We ask of no monetary payback from you, only your listenership and your dedication to making the world a better place. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. Thank you so much for joining us here at the Bruce Collins Show, where you can find us every Friday night at midnight here at WWPR 1490 AM. Remember, God loves you. We do too. Don't give up.